Hey, this is Greg Little from Bethany Baptist Church. I'm so thankful that you decided to join us on this podcast. I trust that the Lord will use it in your life to encourage you, strengthen you, and challenge you wherever you are in your walk with Him. For more information about Bethany, you can visit us online at bethanybc.ca. Now let's open our hearts and minds to what the Lord has for us. We're in Matthew chapter 24 this morning, Matthew chapter 24. And I'm just going to start reading in verse number 1, and we'll read down to verse number 8. We're going to cover a very large section of Scripture here this morning, but we'll just start reading in verse 1 down to verse number 8, and then we'll look. Really, we're going to take over half the chapter and look at the beginning of it this morning. Matthew 24 and 25 are the final teaching that Jesus gives to the disciples before His arrest, His betrayal, His crucifixion, His resurrection. So this is really the last time of training that Jesus has for His disciples. We find it here in this section. So let's start reading in verse number 1, and we'll read down to verse number 8. And Jesus went out and departed from the temple, and His disciples came to Him for to show Him the buildings of the temple. And Jesus said unto them, See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down. And as He sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto Him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of Thy coming and of the end of the world? And Jesus answered and said unto them, Take heed that no man deceive you. For many shall come in My name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive many. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled, for these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. For nation shall rise against nation, and kingdom against kingdom, and there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. All these are the beginning of sorrows. We'll start our reading there this morning. What is it, though, that comes to your mind when I say the word prophecy? Bible prophecy. I'm sure for a lot of people that evokes a lot of thoughts, a lot of pictures in their minds, a lot of ideas, because prophecy is a big business. There's a lot involved in that. It's really something, I think, that's talked about more and more and more, especially as all of these world events happen around us. Doesn't it seem to you like we are living in the last days? It does to me. And it's not just Christians talking about it. Everybody's talking about it. Time magazine had an article, and this was back, I believe it was in 2002, so it was a number of years ago. And the article was titled this, The Bible and the Apocalypse, Why the End of the World? This is Time Magazine. It's talking about the Bible and the apocalypse and the end of the world. And in that story, again, over 20 years ago, the author highlighted the rise of attention that is being given to end time discussions by not just Christians, but by the general population in North America. He was noting that everybody seems to be talking about it. I think probably even more so now, 20 years later, than they were back in 2002. So there's a lot of people talking about prophecy and end times, not just Christians in North America. And of course, with that, there is a lot of confusion and a lot of debate and a lot of uncertainty. There's a lot in the Bible that speaks to prophecy and of end times. And there's a lot of pictures and a lot of illustrations. And I don't know about you, but you try to put all that together. And sometimes, how many of you find that just a little bit confusing sometimes? You don't have to admit it. It's okay. I'll put my hand up first, okay? There's a little bit in there that's confusing and we're unsure of and we don't really No, it's some of it's hard to understand, and that's exactly where the disciples are in Matthew chapter 24. They're feeling the same way. This final teaching session before the arrest and crucifixion of Jesus. Now, keep in mind that we've been following over the last number of weeks, the last week of Jesus' life, the Passion Week, we called it. And these events in Matthew 24 and 25 happen on the Tuesday evening, just days before his crucifixion, right? Jesus has just finished up his public earthly ministry. He's done with the Pharisees. He's done with the religious leaders. He's moving on and spending. He's not quite done with the disciples yet, but he's coming to an end. He's bringing it all to a close. And Matthew tells us here in verse 1 that as they come out of the temple and they're coming out of Jerusalem, as they're leaving that temple, the disciples look back and they see the temple and all the buildings and the beauty of all the infrastructure of first century Jerusalem. And they're looking at that temple and those buildings, and maybe there's a beautiful sunset in the sky, and it's kind of accentuating that the temple and all of those buildings, and it's impressive, right? And they look at that and they see it and they say, "Hey, Jesus, look at these buildings. Isn't that beautiful? Isn't that impressive? Look how magnificent the temple is and all these buildings." In Mark's account, they say, "Master, what massive stones." Like, look at the ingenuity of the building of this temple. Look at how big those stones are. They say, "What massive, what a magnificent building." And the reality is, it was beautiful. There was nothing quite like this. And they're looking and they're impressed by the beauty and the stature, the size of this building. And Jesus' response is not really what we would expect, is it? We might expect Jesus to say, "You know, yes, it is beautiful. What work went into that? What a beautiful place. This is my Father's house, right? It's a place of prayer." But that's not what Jesus says, is it? He says in verse number 2, "See ye not all these things? Verily I say unto you, there shall not be left here one stone upon another that shall not be thrown down." In other words, the disciples say, "Master, look at these buildings." And Jesus says, "This whole thing is coming down." Right? There's a time coming where this whole temple is going to be broken down one stone at a time. There won't be two stones left standing by the time it's done. There'll be nothing left. Now, we know, the disciples didn't know this, but looking back, we know that in 70 AD, this is exactly what happens to the city. It is completely destroyed. The Roman army comes in and they take that temple apart stone by stone. It was overlaid with gold in many areas, and they took it apart to get that, and the whole temple, everything came down. But the disciples are thinking about this, and I'm sure that Jesus' answer shocked them. That's not what they were expecting. And I'm sure as they're walking out of the city, that they're processing this. Did Jesus really just say that? Did he really just say that all of this is coming down? They get to the Mount of Olives. I don't know if you can see that or not, this picture up here, but the temple's kind of right there in the middle. I don't know if my pointer's working. I don't think it is. The temple's right in the middle of that, and then you go a little bit to the east, you go out, and there's the Mount of Olives. So they're out there, they're sitting on the Mount of Olives, they can still see the temple, they can still see much of Jerusalem. They come out, and they ask Jesus about what he said. And Jesus' answer, which covers Matthew 24 and 25, is what we call the Olivet Discourse. Jesus is sitting on the Mount of Olives, and he gives this reply in this chapter and the next chapter to the disciples. And it starts with this question. It says in verse 3, "And as he sat upon the Mount of Olives, the disciples came unto him privately, saying, Tell us, when shall these things be? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world?" The obvious question is on the disciples' mind. Jesus says, listen, not one stone is going to be left upon another. This whole thing is coming down. If Jesus said to you this morning, this church is going to be completely destroyed, it's going to be razed to the ground, what is the first question that would be on your mind? You'd probably say, when is that going to happen? When should I be prepared for this? Like, when is this going to take place? And that's exactly what the disciples asked. They say, Jesus, when are these things going to be? When is this going to take place? But then they ask another question. This is really important for us to remember. And I want you to kind of lock this away because this is the key to the whole passage, to understanding Matthew 24 and 25. They ask when, but then they ask a second question. They say, what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? Those are two totally different questions. And Jesus is going to answer them both. But they don't refer to the same thing necessarily. So they ask, when will these things be? Speaking of the temple. And then they ask, and what will be the sign of your coming? And at the end of the world. Those are two very distinct questions with two very different answers. And a lot of people, I just say that because a lot of people tend to confuse those two when they interpret this passage. There's a near event that's going to happen soon in our lifetime, and there's a far event that is still to come. And Jesus references both of those in this chapter. And sometimes the near event, the destruction of Jerusalem, serves as a picture or a symbol of the far event, the second coming of Christ. And so we have to keep that in our mind. We don't want to confuse those two things. Now, there's so much that I could say here. There's a lot in these two chapters, and I was thinking this way. We could either do a really deep dive into some prophecy and spend a number of weeks here, or I could do kind of an overview and spend just a few weeks on these couple of chapters. And so I think I'm going to do the latter. I'm not going to get through all of it. We're not going to look at all of it in detail, but we're going to make our way just quickly through Matthew 24 and 25. I think probably 2 or 3 weeks we'll spend on this. So it's kind of, we could go a whole lot deeper. Maybe sometime we'll do that. We'll go into a deeper dive, but we're just going to kind of look at it as an overarching view of these two chapters. And so chapter 24 and 25 are really divided into three sections. I'm going to give you the three sections. Those will probably be the 3 weeks that we look at it. And then I'm going to give you some principles for interpreting, and then we'll get into the passage, okay? I don't want to get too deep here this morning, but I do need to lay a little bit of groundwork as we look at these passages. So first of all, the three divisions of these chapters are the number one is the main part of Matthew 24. It goes from verse 1 all the way down to verse number 35. And this passage, the first section, starts with the events that take place during the entirety of the church age and then moves into the events that take place just during and near the end of the Great Tribulation. And then And that's pictured by the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And then it goes into the coming of Christ, the second coming at the end of the tribulation. So that's the first section. It kind of starts and it goes through all of church history into the very end of the tribulation. And then the second section in verse 36 down into chapter 35 gives us lessons that we take from that. So lessons on waiting and watching and being prepared for the coming of Jesus. There's some parables in there. There's the parable of the faithful and the unfaithful servants. The parable of the 10 virgins. Some prepared, some not prepared. There's the parable of the talents. And really the second section is more application of the first. And we'll probably get into that next week. And then the third and final section at the end of chapter 25 is a warning of judgment and a promise of reward at the time of his coming. So take all of these things, take the theology of it, so to speak, the application of it, and then we're going to see the warning and the reward at the end of that. So that's kind of how we'll divide these next couple of chapters. Are you still with me this morning? I haven't lost anyone yet. Okay. I don't want this to get too overly theological and just to get an exercise in head knowledge. I want this to be practical as well. What do we do with all of this and helpful to you? So let me just give you a few foundational principles for interpreting not just this passage, but really when you come to any passage like this, there's some principles that will help you to be able to interpret it and understand what the author is saying. So first of all, there's a contextual principle. And what I mean by that is simply this. When we come, especially when we come to a passage like this, how many of you have heard somebody read current events in a biblical prophecy? I'm sure you have. People try to do that all the time. So what's happening right now in the world is exactly what's happening in this, so to speak. They're reading it into the passage. And we have to be careful of that because people could have done that all through history. It's easy to read current events or global happenings into this passage, but there's a danger in that. So when we come to a passage like this, the question is not, what does this passage mean to me? Or how do I feel about it? Or what do I think about this passage? The question is, what did this passage mean to the original hearers? So when Jesus spoke it to the disciples, how did they interpret it? What did it mean to them? And the early church, how would they have understood this passage? I think that's why context is so important. There's so much that's taken out of context. You could really make the Bible say whatever you wanted it to say. And that's why there's so much confusion around prophecy. And I think that's why there's a lot of contention when it comes to prophecy. I'm sure you've probably seen that as well, the people that have these kind of views in their mind and are very contentious about it and want to argue about it. There's a lot of superiority sometimes when it comes to prophecy. There's a lot of people that think they know so much more than anybody else. And all I am saying is this, ambiguous issues of prophecy should not divide us. There's more that we don't know than what we do know when it comes to prophecy. So we have to be careful. Listen, as Jesus speaks this to the disciples, keep this in your mind that Jesus expects those men to understand in that moment what he's saying. Right? They don't even understand yet the death and the burial and resurrection of Jesus. They don't understand the church age. There's a lot that they don't understand, so we shouldn't expect this to be overly complicated and detailed. The purpose of what we're about to read, listen, Jesus wants his disciples and he wants us as we read it. This is what he wants. He wants us to have assurance that everything is happening right on schedule and in his plan and in his purposes, and he's in control of all of it. That's what he wants them to know. We don't have to know all the details. We don't have to read too much into it. We just need to know that God's in control and live like this is true. So, as we read this passage, it's just enough here for us to look around and say, you know what? This is happening just like Jesus said it would. This is exactly what he said was going to happen. And the takeaway is that when we turn on the news and we see what's going on in the world, we don't need to be afraid because we know it's all happening according to schedule, right? This is exactly what Jesus said was going to happen. I can see it unfolding. I can see it happen. So I trust him even more. I know he's in control, right? So there's a contextual principle. Then remember this, that God has a plan. God is in control. God has a plan for all the nations of the earth. God has a plan for Israel. God has a plan for the church. God has a plan for all of those, and God is not done with those plans. God's not done with Israel. God is doing something with the church, and all of that is converging together. And some people mix up God's plan for the church and God's plan for Israel and kind of mix those together. But God has a plan for the nations, for the church, and for Israel, and he's working all of those things together. And so I don't want us to confuse those things. And then thirdly, and just quickly, there are, when we come to Scripture, we need to understand, especially when we come to prophecy, that the Bible speaks of two future comings of Jesus Christ. Right? When you look at all the body of Scripture, you can't help but conclude that there are at least two comings of Jesus. There is a partial calling. That's what we call the rapture, the calling up. And the second coming, where Jesus establishes his kingdom. And there's a lot that we don't know about both, but there are two. One is imminent. One is for believers. It could happen any moment at any time. And it's a comforting hope to us. The other happens at the end of the tribulation period. And it's not for the church, but it's where Jesus comes with the church. And it's not so comforting. It's actually a time of awe and fear and judgment. And here's a way that you can remember the two. I think this will help you with the two comings of Christ. One of them, the rapture, is like a groom coming to a wedding. Right? And those evoke good pictures in your mind, comforting pictures. Right? The other, the second coming, is a judge coming for final judgment, for final war. And so, with all that being said, I want you to keep in mind as we make our way through Matthew 24, and we're going to get into it now, but Jesus is speaking here of the second coming. All right, the church age all the way through the tribulation up to the second coming of Christ. So, I know that can be a little bit confusing trying to keep those separate. But I think as we come to the end of this chapter, we'll understand and have a good understanding of these things. And so we're going to try to move pretty quickly through here this morning. But I want you to notice, first of all, the signs of his coming. The signs of his coming in verses 4 through 31. Jesus is saying, so the question is, when are these things going to happen? And what shall be the sign of thy coming and of the end of the world? And Jesus answers those questions. And he says, listen to the disciples, there is going to be a lengthy season before I come back. And this is exactly what it's going to look like. And this is what is going to characterize that whole season from now, the beginning of the church age, all the way up until my coming. He doesn't give any dates. He doesn't give any specifics. He's speaking much in generalities. In fact, he says this is going to happen, but it's not the end yet. And this is going to happen, and the end is soon, but not yet. And then this is going to happen, and then you'll know it's the end. So all of these things are going to happen. Notice, first of all, then, the beginning of birth pains. Jesus says in verse 8, all of these are the beginning of sorrows. The word sorrows there is the Greek word odin, and it has the idea of childbirth. This is the beginning of childbirth. This is the beginning of birth pains. Now, I can't really speak into this as much as some of you can. You know a whole lot better than me what birth pains are like. Many of you ladies here. I don't really have any idea. I kind of watched it from the outside, and I know it's painful, but I don't really understand. I mean, I had a cold once, and I'm pretty sure that was close, but no, the man cold, right? But I do know this. Childbirth is not necessarily a time of sorrow, but it is a time of pain. And it doesn't just come suddenly. Right? There's a lot of contractions. There's a lot of pain leading up to childbirth. There are a lot of signs that say, hey, the baby's coming and the baby's coming soon, but it's not quite here yet. Right? You know what I'm talking about. There's all these signs. You know the baby's coming. The baby's not here yet. That's what Jesus links these to. That it is a time of sorrows. It's like a time of labor. All of these signs that Jesus give, they're difficult signs, but they all point to the fact that Jesus is coming. He is coming soon. Not quite yet, but these are the birthing pains. These are the contractions. This is the beginning of the process. All right, so what are the signs? We'll look at them here. Verse 4 and 5, Jesus answered and said unto them, take heed that no man deceive you, for many shall come in my name, saying, I am Christ, and shall deceive you. One of the signs of Jesus' coming is religious deception. And by the way, this has been happening from the moment that Jesus left. This kind of religious deception has been happening in this world. There are so many examples from the first century all the way up until today of these false religions, these false teachers who claim to be Christ, who claim to be the Messiah. I looked up when I was studying an article on Wikipedia. So I'll just tell you, that's what I looked it up. I don't know how trustworthy it is, but I looked it up and it said, it gave a list of people throughout the ages who claim to be Jesus. And there are a lot who have claimed to be the Messiah. It starts all the way in the first century, and every century there are more and more people. And in fact, I found it interesting that as the centuries increased, as we get closer to today, the list gets bigger and bigger and bigger of people each century who are claiming to be the Messiah. Jesus says, don't be deceived. That's going to happen. There's going to be religious deception. Look at verse 6. And ye shall hear of wars and rumors of wars. See that ye be not troubled. For all these things must come to pass, but the end is not yet. Listen, have you heard of wars this morning? Or rumors of wars? Listen, this isn't just in the tribulation period. This is happening right now. You know, in the last 2,000 years, there has been no point in the last 2,000 years where the world has fully been at peace. There's always been a war somewhere, in some place. According to the Peace Research Institute in Oslo, they said that the number of armed conflicts globally has rarely dropped below 30 per year since the mid-20th century. 30 per year. One historian estimated that in 3,400 years of recorded history, only 268 of those years were free from war in this world. That's only 8% of all of recorded history. There's wars and rumor. It seems like you can't turn on the news without hearing about another war or another conflict. War in Ukraine, war in the Middle East, war in Africa. And it all seems to be escalating. Right? Jesus says this is going to happen. There will be no true world peace until Jesus comes. But notice just quickly what Jesus says in the middle of that. He says, see that ye be not troubled, for all these things must come to pass. Don't be troubled. Don't be alarmed. These things have to happen. Can I say it to you this way this morning? We have a seat in the grandstands of time, watching Jesus' plan unfold. We get to see that happen. All of this is in his control. Elections, wars, unrest, famines, pestilence, global disasters. This is all, God knows all of these things. This is all part of his timeline. You say, well, what if this nation falls? What if our government falls and an even more tyrannical government takes its place? Listen, if that happened this morning, let me say this. Nothing of eternal value would change. God would still be in control. There would be nothing different eternally because God's plan is still unfolding. In fact, when you look at world history, it should actually surprise us that we have had peace for so long because that's not been the norm. We have so much freedom and so much liberty that people down through the ages have not had. So Jesus says these things must happen, but the end is not yet. Verse 7, for nation shall rise against nation and kingdom against kingdom. That follows verse 6. And there shall be famines and pestilences and earthquakes in divers places. Does that sound like the news at all to you? It seems like we hear about that every day. Not only with greater frequency, but bigger. It seems like every day there's a new record set in this catastrophe or whatever it might be, earthquakes and famines and cataclysmic events. It seems like we would hear about them every once in a while, but now it's every day. By the way, this isn't man-made global warming. Jesus says this is what's going to happen. This is what's going to take place. Listen, should this cause us to be terrified? Jesus said, don't be troubled. I'm in control. It's going to get worse and worse. This is just the beginning of sorrows in verse 8. Verse 9, then shall they deliver you up to be afflicted and shall kill you, and you shall be hated of all nations for my name's sake. And then shall many be offended and shall betray one another and shall hate one another. Jesus is speaking here of persecution. Again, this doesn't surprise us. What should surprise us is that we've lived so long without this kind of persecution. Jesus told us to expect it. He said, yea, those that live godly in Christ Jesus, well, what? They will suffer persecution. This is going to happen. You know, there are people all over the world, even this morning, even right now, who are being betrayed by their families, who are being persecuted for their faith and even killed for their faith. This is happening right now all across the world. Just because we live in a place where we have freedom and peace doesn't mean it's not taking place, because it is. Verse 11, many false prophets shall rise and deceive many, and because iniquity shall abound, the love of many shall wax cold. But he that shall endure unto the end, the same shall be saved. Not only is there persecution, but again, there's false prophets. There are those that are growing cold in their love. Jesus writes a letter to the church of Ephesus in Revelation chapter 2, and he says that you have left your first love. You have grown cold. And Jesus says those that endure unto the end shall be saved. We read this morning, 1 Corinthians 15, be steadfast, unmovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord. Don't let this persecution take you off course. If it comes, as it comes, be steadfast, be unmovable, endure through it, be committed. Then in verse 14, and this gospel of the kingdom shall be preached in all the world for a witness unto all nations, and then shall the end come. It's interesting here that Jesus says the gospel will be preached in all the world. And then what's going to happen? And then the end will come. As the gospel is preached in all the world, then the end will come. That's the defining mark. That is, if I can say it this way, the last contraction. Jesus said, I'm going to come again when the gospel is preached to all the nations. So let me ask you, how are we doing with that? In his book, I have it in my office. The book is called And Then the End Will Come by Douglas Cobb. If you're looking for some summer reading, I would highly recommend that book. It's a great book. And he says, in one of his chapters, out of the 12,000 people groups, by the way, that's what the word nations mean. When the Bible uses the word nation, it's talking about people groups. So out of the 12,000 people groups in this world today, he said, we can say with confidence that there are believers in over 11,500 of them. That just leaves a couple hundred people groups that have never had any access to the gospel. No Bible, no witness, no message. He goes on to say, in 2005, there are more than 3,500 unreached people groups, a population of over 700 million people. In 2015, that number was down to 1,400 people groups, and today, only a few hundred people groups left. The reality is the gospel is going out all across the world. And Jesus says, when it does, then the end will come. These are the signs of his coming. So these take us from all through the church age. I want you to notice, secondly, the sign of Jesus' soon second coming. This is taking us through the tribulation period, and we're gonna make our way really quickly through these verses. But let's just read them, starting in verse 15. We'll go down to verse number 28. When ye therefore shall see the abomination of desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet, stand in the holy place. Whoso readeth, let him understand. Then let him which be in Judah flee unto the mountains. Let him which is on the housetop not come down to take anything out of his house. Neither let him which is in the field return back to take his clothes. And woe unto them that are with child, and to them that give suck in those days. But pray ye that your flight be not in the winter, neither on the Sabbath day. For then shall be great tribulation, such as was not since the beginning of the world to this time, no, nor shall ever be. And except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is Christ, or there, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets, and shall show great signs and wonders, insomuch that, if it were possible, they shall deceive the very elect. Behold, I have told you before. Wherefore, if they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the desert, go not forth. Behold, he is in the secret chambers, believe it not. For as the lightning cometh out of the east, and shineth even unto the west, so also shall the coming of the Son of Man be. For wheresoever the carcass is, there will the eagles be gathered together. Again, just very quickly through here, these are the signs that take place during the tribulation period. And Jesus zooms in on a very specific future moment. He zooms in on the abomination of desolation spoken of by Daniel in chapter 9 and verse 27. Now this happened in part in 70 AD, where they came in, Antioch Epiphanes came in and committed the sacrifice in the middle of the temple, the abomination of desolation. So it happened in part, but this prophecy wasn't fully fulfilled. There is a day yet to come where the Antichrist comes in and sacrifices on the rebuilt Temple Mount, the abomination of desolation. And really what we see here in these 14 verses, and this is the idea, is that all this global attention starts to turn toward Israel and the Jewish nation. That is a sign of the times. And aren't we seeing that today? And notice, God knows this, and God sees what's coming. He says to them, when you see this happen, then do this, flee into the mountains. And he tells his people how to respond. Flee to the mountains, protect yourself, hide from your enemies. He sees what's going on, but notice he also limits the suffering. In verse number 22, it says, except those days should be shortened, there should no flesh be saved, but for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Jesus shows, even in judgment, God shows his mercy. He's preparing his people. So that's the sign of the great tribulation. And then verse 29 down to 31, this is the signs of the imminent coming, the imminent second coming of Christ. He says immediately in verse 29, after the tribulation of those days shall the sun be darkened, and the moon shall not give her light, and the stars shall fall from heaven, and the powers of the heavens shall be shaken, and then shall appear the sign of the Son of Man in heaven. And then shall all the tribes of the earth mourn, and they shall see the Son of Man coming in the clouds of heaven with power and great glory, and he shall send his angels with a great sound of trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. This is the climax of the whole chapter. This is what it's all been building to all through the church age. The tribulation has been building toward this. And the point is this: Jesus is coming back. He is coming back. This is at the end of the tribulation, a time of great suffering, that Jesus returns with his bride to rule and reign in righteousness. And he'll put an end to all sin and all rebellion. And we're going to look at this a little more next week. But Jesus says this: when all of this happens, then you'll know that the time is close. And the reality is this, nobody knows the time or the hour, but I can't help but think that we are getting close. We see all of these signs. You say, man, we must be getting closer and closer. All of these things are going on. So there's a lot in there, but I don't want you to leave you just with that. I want to, just as we finish up, maybe the next 5 minutes or so, end with this. So if all of this is happening, what do I do with all this? Why does Jesus tell us all of this information? What do I do with all of these details? How do I apply that? And so I want you to notice, secondly, the strength for the crisis. So we know these things are going to take place. What is our strength in this? How can we not be fearful and be afraid? We see all of these signs happening. We see all of this going on around us. What should we do in light of this truth? Let me give you a couple things really quickly. First of all, remember that his coming is sure. His coming is sure. It says in verse 33, "So likewise ye, when ye shall see all these things, know that it is near, even at the doors. Verily I say unto you, this generation shall not pass till all these things be fulfilled." See, we might not know all the facts. And we might find out someday that we were wrong on certain eschatological points, that we didn't have it all right. But the reality is this, the truth is this, Jesus is coming again. His second coming is mentioned 318 times in the New Testament. It speaks to his second coming. It is a reality. We could say it this way, God's prophecies are God's promises. He said it's going to happen. It will happen. God does not lie. He doesn't change his mind. He said he was coming back, and so he will. If the Bible is true, and we know that it is, then there is no doubt. Jesus said it. He is coming back. You can rest assured in it. Yes, we can look around at this world and see it's a mess. We can look at our own nation and say, can it get any worse? And it can, and it will. But none of that should scare us. None of that should surprise us. Everything is unfolding exactly like Jesus said it would. Jesus said in verse 35, "Heaven and earth shall pass away, but my word shall not pass away." It is true. Jesus says, "I will do exactly what I said I would." And friends, that gives me great confidence. It should give you great confidence and great peace this morning. That even though it seems like everything is unraveling before us, it's actually just Jesus' plan being unfolded. And he will come back like he said he would. We have confidence in that. His coming is sure, but secondly, his mission is our goal. If all of these things are true, and they are, what does that mean for me? I think it means a couple of things. I think, first of all, it means that I'm going to be motivated to godly living. Right? Jesus doesn't give us these things. He doesn't unfold this chapter for us so that we can argue and fight over dates and specifics and speculations. That's not why he gives it to us. He tells us these things so that we would look for his coming and live godly in this present world. I don't know exactly when he's coming, and I don't need to know. I just know that he is. So I need to live like he's coming. And he could come at any moment. But secondly, not only should it motivate me to godly living, I think secondly, it gives me motivation to be involved in his mission, in evangelism and missions. The reality is this, Jesus hasn't returned yet because he's long-suffering. He's not willing that any should perish, but that all should come to repentance. There are still souls to be saved. There are still men and women that need to hear the gospel. The souls of men and women are at stake. Jesus said he wouldn't come until the gospel is preached across the world. So let's do that. Let's get involved in that mission. Let's prepare people to meet the Lord when he comes. And listen, till he comes, no matter how bad things get in the court of public opinion, no matter how bad things get in the political arena, no matter how much the government may legislate against Christianity, no matter how much persecution we may endure, the gospel cannot be stopped. It will go forth. It's amazing to me even today to look at some of the nations of the world where Christians are persecuted the most and see that those are the places where the gospel is exploding. Because the world can't stop it. The gates of hell won't prevail against it. The gospel cannot be stopped until Jesus returns in power and in glory. It will accomplish its purpose. The kingdom is advancing. And man, I want to be a part of that. I want to get on the same mission as Jesus and win people to him. His mission is our goal. And thirdly and finally, his warning is clear. Right now, God is long-suffering. Right now, God is withholding judgment and extending mercy to the world. He's not willing that any should perish. Right? But friends, we are getting closer and closer to the day where there will be no more mercy. No more opportunity. Sometimes we think of this kind of prophecy and the end times and it scares us, but the reality is this: if we know Christ, then we have complete peace and none of this scares us. In fact, this brings us hope and comfort, knowing that God is in control. But if we don't know Christ, then this is terrifying. And it ought to scare us. The reality is you can know Jesus today. You can enter into a relationship with him where you are saved from this, where you are secure. And you don't have to be part of this tribulation, but you need to come to him by faith. His warning is clear. There is hope in his broken world, but the hope is in Jesus, and Jesus alone. So if you don't know him this morning, I'd encourage you to come to him, to know him by faith.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. My prayer is that God would use the preaching of his word in your life in a special way. If there's any way that we can be a help to you, please feel free to reach out at bibcinfo@gmail.com. Or if you're in the area, you're always welcome to come join us in worshiping the Lord together every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock and Wednesday at 6:30. May the Lord bless you today.